Well, I watch the news sometimes. Sometimes I don't. Instead of just watching the news, the truth of the matter is I usually end up reading a lot about what's going on in the world. At any rate, since I was a kid, I've had a love-hate relationship with information, the news in particular. There are lots of reasons for that. And while I was a kid, I did, in fact, read my Spider-Man comic books. I want you to know that also during those days, my parents gave me a subscription to the Kiplinger Washington newsletter, and I read it. In fairness to my blasé disposition about the news these days, it's important to note that years ago, long time ago anyway, it was actually the news that was being reported, not some left-leaning or right-leaning slant on the news, just the news. Sometimes wouldn't it be good to just hear some really good news? Maybe even something that would be a bit humorous. One of our church's associate pastors, my friend Bob Chichester, recently shared this, and I thought it was hilarious. A 23-year-old Alabama woman was arrested earlier this month for harassing her ex-boyfriend following his breakup with her. She used the online request forms with Jehovah's Witnesses to schedule missionary visits to his home every 30 minutes for 3 consecutive days, beginning at 8 o'clock in the morning. Each submission described her ex as very open to long conversations and going through a life transition. After dozens of visits in a single day, the man contacted the police. Officers traced the request to a prepaid card and an email address, and the woman was arrested on charges of harassment and misuse of electronic communication. You know that's funny. And don't get any ideas either. It's important that we have some laughter from time to time. So funny news is certainly worthwhile, but truly good news is what's most helpful. I'm sure you know that there are even websites dedicated to sharing only positive news stories. And I know that's hard to believe, but again, let me remind you, we live in a world that believes Elvis is alive and living in Michigan, hanging out at a Wendy's. So it's not that far out of the realm of possibility. This morning, we're going to talk about some good news, some really good news, in fact. I mean, if you think through the main so-called talking points that we'll be sharing today, I think you'll agree overall it's really good news. Probably some news that, at least I hope anyway, will greatly encourage all of us. All around the world today, we Christians remember the good news of Jesus. We mark Palm Sunday, and remember the fact that Jesus rode into Jerusalem ultimately in preparation for that which would happen later in the week, the establishment, for example, of the Lord's Supper, certainly his crucifixion, and then, of course, his resurrection from the dead. Bad Friday actually is Good Friday, and next Sunday we celebrate that for those in Jesus, death has died. And that is certainly good news. And all the way back in the Old Testament, we see God's hand at work, preparing the world and certainly preparing his people for the coming Savior. We're continuing this morning, verse by verse, through the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel. We've learned about Elkanah and Hannah and Peninnah and Eli and Hophni and Phinehas, as well as Samuel. Now this morning, we're going to be learning about Saul, and pretty soon we'll be dealing with Jonathan and then David and Goliath, as well as others. Anyway, throughout 1 Samuel, we see the reality of God's rule and God's reign. In other words, God's sovereignty. Thus, the title of the series we continue this morning, Snapshots of Sovereignty. And we're in 1 Samuel chapter 9. We'll begin our reading with the very first verse, 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1. If you're able, I'll invite you to stand, please, for the reading of God's holy word. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zerah, son of Bichorah, son of Aphiah, a Benjaminite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to Saul, his son, "Take one of the young men with you and arise and go look for the donkeys." And he passed through the hill country of Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. And they passed through the land of Shalem, but they were not there. Then they passed through the land of Benjamin, but did not find them. When they came to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come, let us go back, lest my father cease to care about the donkeys and become anxious about us." But he said to him, "Behold, there is a man of God in this city, and he is a man who is held in honor. All that he says comes true. So now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us the way we should go." Then Saul said to his servant, "But if we go, what can we bring the man? For the bread in our sacks is gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" The servant answered Saul again, "Here, I have with me a quarter of a shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way." Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he said, "Come, let us go to the seer," for today's prophet was formerly called a seer. And Saul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. As they went up the hill to the city, they met young women coming out to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" They answered, "He is. Behold, he is just ahead of you. Hurry. He has come just now to the city because the people have a sacrifice today on the high place. As soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat till he comes, since he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now go up, for you will meet him immediately." So they went up to the city. As they were entering the city, they saw Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the high place. Thank you so much. You may be seated. Well, last week we started with a detour before two main points of the sermon. This morning I'm going to do the same before we get to our three main thoughts. The outline is very simple, and the detour I'm offering to set the stage is, in fact, redundant, but here it is. The sovereignty of God is the only thing that makes the world make sense. This is foundational for everything else we're going to say. The sovereignty of God is the only thing that makes the world make sense. Now, you are potentially already tired, or you will grow tired of me saying the same thing each week in this regard. If nothing else, I trust you'll recognize as we see the hand of God working in the world, you'll see the rationale for calling this whole series through 1 Samuel snapshots of sovereignty. When you talk about the concept of God's sovereignty, don't make it more complex than what it really is. We're really just talking about God being God. God doing what God chooses to do, God doing things, God causing things, God stopping things, God allowing things, God being large and in charge, and make no mistake, we believe he really is large and in charge. Even when it's hard, we believe that. Even when we don't understand, even when it contradicts conventional wisdom, listen, the foundation of the Christian faith is our belief that a dead man, albeit the God-man, Jesus, got up and walked out of a grave. That's hard. We don't fully understand it, and it certainly contradicts conventional wisdom. Fair enough. A dead man got up and walked. So as we think about the way God superintends events in the world, I think it's important to see how he works in big ways and how he works in small ways. Israel is about to get a king, and I want you to notice how this is going to work. There's no pomp and circumstance. There's no fanfare at this particular point. It's actually a pretty uneventful account in terms of how things are going. Some would perhaps even say, this is dull. Let me just remind us about how many important things transpire in our world in the midst of the dull, the everyday, the mundane. Samuel knows what's about to transpire, but what are we to make of Saul? The soon-to-be leader of the Israelites is introduced to us via an account of searching for donkeys that belonged to his father. Now, bear in mind, Saul comes from the tribe of Benjamin, and you say, okay, big deal. What's the big deal about that? Well, remember, we believe everything that God does, he does with purpose. He does on purpose. He has a reason for what he does. In this case, Benjamin is one of the smallest tribes of Israel. In all likelihood, and I can't prove that this is the case, but it could be, in all likelihood, this will ensure, because the tribe was so small, at least potentially less rivalries as Saul ascends to the throne. And what is it that is so extraordinary about Saul? Well, frankly, not much. He's tall, taller than most. In fact, it appears as if his resume is lacking. It feels like the case in the life of what the Bible calls this handsome young man, that there's not a whole lot that's gone on. That seems to be really such a big deal. Handsome and young. I mean, I've been there and done that. Handsome and young. That seems to be the big deal. There's much we could dismiss about his seeming lack of drive and lack of credential. We could sort of pass that off on youthfulness, except we discover when we get to chapter 13, it's likely Saul is about 40 years old at the time. Anyway, back to the mundane. Donkeys that belong to Saul's father have gone missing, as they say. Saul is sent to find them. He looks around for a while, and verse 20 makes it clear that it was 3 days. Saul then decides it's time to give up the search. His compadre, his servant, suggests that they should find a man of God. The man of God turns out to be Samuel. Samuel ends up being used by God to demonstrate that Saul is the man chosen to be the king. And in so many ways, all of this, everything I've told you thus far, is so very ordinary. But in the midst of the ordinary, make no mistake, God is connecting the dots to accomplish his purposes. Ultimately, again, the only thing that makes all of this make sense is ultimately the sovereignty of God. Well, with that behind us, let's move ahead. Number one, God utilizes those who fail. God utilizes those who fail. We get this from verses 1 through 4. Let's pick up with verse 3 for the sake of time. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to Saul, his son, take one of the young men with you and arise and go look for the donkeys. And he passed through the hill country of Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalisha, but they did not find them. And they passed through the land of Shalem, but they were not there. Then they passed through the land of Benjamin, but did not find them. God utilizes those who fail. This fact alone is this one point is worth the price of admission this morning. Saul, whose name means asked of God, is introduced to our story as a handsome young man. The use of the word young is not mainly a description of age in this sense, but rather describes a fully grown man, robust in his deportment. The same word in the original language is elsewhere rendered chosen. So Saul is a man who is, in fact, chosen. And as we'll see in the next few weeks, at this point, Saul is likely pushing 40. He's not a kid. And while he may appear winsome and makes a good presence, those two things do not a king make. To say he was handsome is not only a description of his appearance, but also the idea of being good, having an overall good disposition. It's likely those things would be favorable for Saul gaining good stature in the eyes of those looking for a king. So he has those couple of things working in his favor. But remember, at the risk of sounding melodramatic, people thought Ted Bundy possessed the very same attributes. To the point, there's no mention here in the text about his spiritual condition. Isn't that interesting? The man that's going to lead the people of God, nothing is said about his spiritual condition. Joseph, you may recall, was young and handsome too. But Genesis 39:3 notes about Joseph, his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. Joseph had the looks And he had the personality, but make no mistake, he also had substance. Saul was still at home playing video games in his dad's house at the age of 40. Kind of. And that was in keeping with Hebrew society of the day. That really was not a big surprise. And Saul goes with his servant to find his father Kish's donkeys. They move along a bit of a haphazard route. They go through the southern part of the hill country of Ephraim, and they go to a couple of other places. And these two places really are not identified. We're not exactly sure where they are. They even go back through the land of Benjamin. The text makes clear three different times, they did not find the donkeys. Thus, we meet Saul for the first time, not as a successful king, but rather as an unsuccessful donkey hunter. Saul can't find his dad's donkeys, but he's going to be entrusted to lead an entire nation. Let that sink in. To the point, failure isn't final, or it doesn't have to be. God will still use Saul. How many of us as believers striving to lead righteous lives in Jesus have thought, there's no way God could use someone like me? A lot of people think that. There's no way God could use somebody like me. And we think that and we feel that. And sometimes we even say that because we've experienced some failures in life. Please note, if you will, that the future king of Israel couldn't even find his dad's donkeys. Further, at some level at least, the text gives us the sense that he's really not all that concerned about much of anything, much less his dad's disappearing donkeys. I mean, why are you willing to bow out of significant service to Jesus because of something you did 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago? Why are you willing to occupy thoughts of your failures from decades ago when the future king of Israel has occupied himself trying to play pin the tail on the donkey, and he can't even do that? Your trivial pursuit is no less important than his. In high school, I didn't do so well with my assessment of the book, The Red Badge of Courage. You guys read the book? Anybody? Two of us? Good. Well, I didn't do so well in my reporting of that book, The Red Badge of Courage, and that's probably due to the fact that I didn't read that book until I was into my 40s. I felt guilty, and I bought the book. It was after we moved here I read The Red Badge of Courage. I still have the paper at home where my English literature teacher in high school, Mr. George, wrote at the top of that paper. Now, in fairness, he was right, what he said. In today's world, he would be fired, but you recognize that was a very different era. He wrote something like, "Parker, with the use of this much tripe in your writing, it's likely the only job you'll ever be equipped to carry out is something connected to the federal government." Now, for the record, I had to look up the definition of the word tripe because I grew up in a concrete jungle. And anyway, I ran into Mr. George several years later when my mother was retiring from teaching school, and he came up to me and said, "So, you're a preacher." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Are you a good one or the Jimmy Swaggart variety?" Anyway, I failed the assignment, a writing assignment, no less. You realize today I write for a living. To the point, God utilizes those who fail. Deal with it. In fact, revel in it. Don't let your life be defined by your weakest or worst moments. This is what many Christians worldwide refer to as Holy Week this week. Have you contemplated, and I trust that you will, the behavior of the ragtag group of guys that Jesus entrusted to carry out his mission? I'm not going to go line by line or talk about each man after each man after each man, but one after the other were in very many ways failures. And that's good news for us. Simon Peter, remember? Simon Peter denied Jesus. He denied that he even knew Jesus three times, and yet he was used by God through the preaching of the gospel of Jesus to see some 3,000 people come to faith in Christ in one day. One sermon, 3,000 people get saved. I'm still waiting. Don't forget about your failures. Learn from them. Someone said, he who never makes a mistake never makes anything. Or as Theodore Roosevelt said, the only man who never makes a mistake is the man who never does anything. Edison spent more than $100,000 to obtain 6,000 different fiber specimens, and only three of them proved satisfactory. Each failure, however, brought him that much closer to the solution to his problem. His friend Henry Ford was right when he said that failure was the, quote, opportunity to begin again more intelligently. So God utilizes those who fail. Secondly, not only God utilizes those who fail, but God utilizes the unprepared. God utilizes the unprepared. Look with me, please, at verse 5 and following. When they came to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, come, let us go back, lest my father cease to care about the donkeys and become anxious about us. But he said to him, behold, there is a man of God in this city, and he is a man who is held in honor. All that he says comes true. So now let's go there. Perhaps he can tell us the way we should go. Then Saul said to his servant, but if we go, what can we bring the man? For the bread in our sacks is gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have? The servant answered Saul again, here I have with me a quarter of a shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way. Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he said, come, let us go to the seer, for today's prophet was formerly called a seer. And Saul said to his servant, well said, come, let us go. So they went to the city where the man of God was. God utilizes the unprepared. Saul and his servants travel through the land of Zuph. That gets them closer to Ramah, which you recognize was Samuel's hometown. And Saul has been looking for these donkeys, the donkeys that belonged to his dad, for some 3 days. And he's done. He's finished. Now, in fairness, we don't know this was a legitimate excuse about his dad becoming uptight over being gone, or if he just wanted to give up. Having raised boys who often lost their socks in their own rooms, I'm going to say he probably just wanted to quit looking, but I can't prove that. The servant knows they're close to a place where a well-respected man of God resides, so he proposes a plan. By the way, as one writer notes, the resourcefulness of the servant highlights, through contrast, the deficiencies of Saul. We see how resourceful the servant is and how deficient Saul really is in these moments. Saul really doesn't seem all that jazzed about going, does he? He's grown. He's a grown man at this point, but he kind of reminds me of the kid who is helping his dad work on the car or do yard work. And I keep waiting for Saul to mumble like the kids do, something like, but do I have to? Do I have to go? But instead he says, what do we have? What can we bring? Wah, wah, wah. And in those days, it would be practice to bring a gift as a goodwill token to the seer. But Saul, even though his father is wealthy, doesn't have anything really to add to the mix. He is, are you ready for this? Unprepared. The future king of Israel is unprepared. And God utilizes the unprepared. Again, the servant takes the initiative. He takes the lead. He notes, here I have with me a quarter of a shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way. Saul will then acquiesce, and off they go. Now, I realize the point that I'm making here could be taken the wrong way. I mean, in the ultimate sense, Saul and his servant did have some little something to offer. About a tenth of an ounce of silver was the gift. So they had something. But the truth is, they really were not prepared. Saul certainly was not. And yet God, in his sovereign way, once again connected the dots and moves Saul further up the line toward becoming the king. I think that we should all do everything we can to prepare for whatever we think we need to do, or what we want to do, or what the Lord wants us to do. We certainly should prepare. My point in making this point about God utilizing the unprepared is not to give an excuse to those who are prone to sloth or procrastination. But the truth is, sometimes God uses the unprepared. Isn't that true? The problem for us is we have this sort of anesthetized version of what we think constitutes proper service to Jesus. When Jesus chose Matthew, the tax collector, to be one of his disciples, we would have come along and we would have patted him on the back and said, "Good job, Jesus. You have chosen well. Matthew brings a breadth of experience to this band that is certainly needed. In fact, he comes highly recommended from the accounting firm of Goldman and Feinstein." You don't get it. "Jesus, you've done so well." Listen, Matthew did not become a disciple from learning how to balance other people's checkbooks. No, his pedigree was nothing of the sort. He used his giftedness to cheat. And God chose him. Sometimes I miss the early days of my ministry, before people expected me to really know anything. I'm telling you, listen, I'm still in over my head. I was in over my head on day one. I'm still in over my head. Every pastor is. Every church leader is. I hate to tell you that because it demonstrates the vulnerability of everybody that's in leadership in the church. Most weeks we deal with something we're not prepared to deal with. Most weeks, we're unprepared for something. Now, that's not for lack of trying. That's just life. That's why, by the way, I won't play Bible trivia. I may not remember off the top of my head the color of the 10 curtains that were in the tabernacle. You guys remember the color of the curtains in the tabernacle? I do. Because I looked in preparation to write that, but I didn't remember when I wrote it. I remember one of the first people with whom I ever shared the gospel. I was a teenager, and so was she. And after I told her everything I knew about Jesus, the cross, the resurrection, and then some, I just knew that my persuasive ability would win her to Christ. And I asked her if she was ready to become a Christian. And she had the audacity to tell the future senior pastor of First Baptist Church of Kearney, "No. No." So, what do you do? Well, I took her through a crash course on Revelation. I did. We talked about the seven churches. We talked about the throne and the seals and the scroll and the lamb. And I made sure to mention the 144,000 of Israel and the fall of Babylon and the great prostitute and the beast. And I didn't understand any of that. But I told her all about it. I don't know. I can't believe she didn't, but she was not ready to believe. I'm sure that poor girl, a grown woman now, has spent thousands in therapy by now. But here's the thing. Even though I wasn't fully prepared like I wish I could have been all those years ago, I think the Lord was honored through my obedience, even though I lacked acumen. To the point, do all you can to prepare, by all means. But don't wait until you think that you're fully prepared to do something. If that had been the case in my life, I still would be waiting to preach my first sermon. Nobody's ever ready for what we end up doing, ultimately. We all start somewhere. So, you're unprepared? Okay. work toward preparation, but be available in the meantime, too. I probably didn't explain the point adequately. Here's what I mean. I think God is just as pleased and just as honored when a grade school child says, "Jesus died on the cross for your sins," as he is a PhD student who says, "Tetelestai, it is finished." But as we noted at the top, this really is good news for all of us. So God utilizes those who fail. God utilizes the unprepared. Number three, God utilizes perfect timing. Perfect timing, verse 11. And they went up the hill to the city. They met young women coming out to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" They answered, "He is. Behold, he is just ahead of you. Hurry. He has come just now to the city because the people have a sacrifice today on the high place. As soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, since he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now go up, for you will meet him immediately." So they went up to the city. As they were entering the city, they saw Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the high place. God utilizes perfect timing. Given that my time is about up, let me finish with this point. Like most cities in the area, this city is up on a hill. That's so that it could be fortified. It's kind of a fortress type thing. It's for safety. And the women are there to draw water. Saul and his companion inquire about where to find the man of God, that is Samuel. And they tell Saul that he has just come back to the city. It's likely that Samuel had been on his route, on his circuit, so to speak. And he's back now in time for a very special celebration. Now remember the donkeys of Kish. Remember that? The donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, had been missing 3 days. The scripture makes it clear, 3 days. Saul gives up, and his servant and Saul, they set out to find the man of God to ask for direction. And Samuel just so happens. What a tremendous coincidence. He's back at the exact time that they come to visit him. To the point, a day earlier or a day later, Saul would have missed Samuel. God always utilizes perfect timing. Have you ever contemplated all the divine appointments you've had in your life? Listen, to the Christian, there's no such thing as coincidence. We don't believe anything just happens by chance. God was involved in you waking up this morning. You know, even if your alarm had to wake you up. My alarm woke me up. I turned to Lori and said, "Man, I didn't see that coming." You know what I mean? It's fast. God was involved in you waking up this morning, and God will be involved in you going to sleep tonight. He saw to it all through your life that you went to school or that you got a job or that you got a ride when you needed to go somewhere. He arranged for you. Out of all of the people in the world, God arranged for you to meet your spouse. The other day when you forgot something at the house and you went back to get it and you were a little bit aggravated about that because you had forgotten to get something, God used that delay in your life to cause you to encounter that person at the coffee shop who needed a word of encouragement that only you could bring. And it made you angry. God's timing is always perfect. The storm that took off some of the shingles from your roof, God did that to keep you from losing your whole roof when the tornado touched down the following week. Don't you get it? God utilizes perfect timing. An oak tree, I'm told, takes around 40 years to mature. Food prepared in the kitchen and cooked in the conventional oven is generally different than a microwave. Can I get a witness? It takes 5 to 20 years for a saltwater pearl to form. The longer the years, the bigger the pearl. You can build a barn in a day. It takes months to build a house, and some would say years to make a home. God's timing, all God's timing. The most important thing that ever happened on the planet was the coming of Jesus, and you would think God would have been in a hurry. But Jesus was a full-term baby. conception, development, birth, growth, maturity. God always uses perfect timing.